Separating the policy from the politics, delving deeper into what is happening in our world today, and sharing the information you may not know if you didn't listen to this show. iHub Radio presents The Lovable Liberal. This is the Anita Rufus Show, civil discourse on current events and politics. Here's Anita.
I've just decided I really like that music. That music has kind of, it makes me want to move. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and you are listening to iHub Radio. I am here live every Thursday from 1 to 3. The show is repeated on Saturday mornings and on Sunday mornings, and you can always find podcasts if you just put iHub Anita Rufus, and it'll come up wherever you listen to your podcasts, or you can go to the iHubRadio.com website and pull down the menu and go to artists or shows or whatever it is they've got there, and it will give you a page which all of us and our shows are written out. And if you scroll down to the one that is my show and click on that, it has a link to get you to the podcast as well. Today's show, live this afternoon from 3 to 4, Randy Florence will be here with Coachella Valley Chronicles. He's going to be doing the second part of his interview with a real mover and shaker here in the Coachella Valley named Dick Oliphant. And from 4 to 6, John McMullen is going to have Jackie Botts on his show. This is someone who covers income inequity and economic survival for something called the California Divide Coalition. This is about how California is leading with a committee that is now debating the harms of slavery and reparations to African Americans here in the state of California. This is the leading edge of some policy approaches that are going to have a huge impact, and that will be part of the John McMullen show this afternoon from 4 to 6. I said I was going to talk about the seven industries that are most desperate for workers. You know, we've been hearing a lot about how, oh, nobody wants to go back to work because they're making too much money on unemployment. Well, there are actually seven industries in particular that are hurting for employees. And many of these jobs do not require a college education. If you've got young people in your family who've been stuck at home since they graduated college and have not had a chance to get out there and they're not sure what they want to do, or if you have some young people who are out of high school, they didn't really want to go to college over the course of the pandemic, they've lost whatever job they had. Here are seven areas where there are real opportunities for good jobs. Sawmills and wood preservation jobs. You've seen, or you should know, that the cost of housing all over the country is just skyrocketing. This is a total seller's market. Well, part of the reason for that is, now that the pandemic's over, people are ready to move. Some people are moving from big cities to more rural areas because they don't want to be around a whole lot of people. And they can't get wood to build houses. Employment at sawmills is back at its pre-pandemic level, just barely, because their paychecks have soared over 10%. Paychecks for people working in sawmills averaging $942 a week. Textile mills, the shortages there are so acute that manufacturers have been turning down contracts from businesses who want to use textile mills in the United States. Non-managerial workers at textile mills saw their pay raise almost 18% to about $880 a week. And this is the equivalent of working on an assembly line in many cases. Specialized long-haul truckers. Now, you know, When Andrew Yang ran for president, he was talking about the need for a national base income for every adult in the country, because things like truckers, millions of those jobs were going to be lost because of self-driving vehicles and other ways of delivering things. Well, right now, specialized long-haul truckers are having to turn away business because they can't find enough drivers. Long-haul truckers, those who pull things specialized, like refrigerated trucks, they're earning an average of almost almost $1,100 a week. And that's up almost 10%. People who work for household and office goods movers, competition for people willing to help move furniture, equipment. The shortage there is so acute that pay for non-managerial workers rose almost 14% just so far this year. Average there is $750 a week for moving things. This is a great way for young people to get a foot out into the world, start earning some money, and decide whether they want to continue their education or whether they want to move up in that kind of an industry. There's something called specialty finishing contractors. These are the people who install things like draperies or closet organizers. Their pay is up 17% so far this year to almost $1,100 a week. Mental health practitioners, these are the non-managerial workers in the offices of psychologists or other mental health workers. Their earnings have jumped 19% just so far this year and 30% over the course of the pandemic. They're making around $40,000 a year, and these are people who are not in management, but who are working in mental health offices, doing whatever it is that needs to be done. And finally, veterinary professionals and technicians. The number of people working in these categories are down about 20,000 workers from where they were before the recession related to the pandemic. And they need more and more people who are willing to work in that field, because so many animals have been adopted as companions for people who were stuck inside all year. Weekly earnings for non-management employees in veterinary clinics is up about 16% to over $1,350 a week. Now, sometimes you need specialized training for some of these jobs. But go get one of the entry-level jobs and take whatever training you have to take to make sure that you are taking advantage of the chance to work in one of these industries that are desperate to find good workers. This is a workers' market at the moment. Workers are having the chance to negotiate salaries, to negotiate perks, because so many people lost their jobs during the pandemic, jobs that are not going to come back. And the extra help they've had, sure, that makes a difference. They can feed their kids and put gas in their car, especially at a time of some inflation. But don't mistake the fact that there's a whole lot of people who, after having had time at home, having lost jobs, struggling to get by, have decided that it's time to make a decision to move in a new direction. And most of the jobs I have just gotten through talking about require no college degree. Young people are as qualified as any others to get into these fields, and it can at least begin to open a door toward moving forward in whatever it is you want your career to be about. Now, I want to switch gears and take us to the Supreme Court, because June is the end of a Supreme Court term that starts in the beginning of October. And this is the month that decisions start coming down that haven't come down before. Things like the whether or not Harvard should have the ability to use affirmative action to have a diverse admissions policy. Whether the sentences against the white supremacists who used violence at Charlottesville should stand. There are some cases that the Supreme Court decides not to take. There are others they take and then rule on. In a surprise to Second Amendment advocates, the Supreme Court declined to take up three challenges to a federal ban on gun ownership for people convicted of nonviolent crimes. What's a nonviolent crime? Well, maybe it's stealing some money from your employer or from the cash register where you work. A nonviolent crime would be, driving the getaway car when people are leaving a bank heist. And there is a federal ban on gun ownership for people who have been convicted of certain nonviolent crimes. And the court said, we're not going to take up those challenges. The decision was handed down without explanation. And this is another instance where the court is kind of playing footsie and avoiding making any further decisions regarding the Second Amendment. It was announced today that Obamacare has survived a third major Supreme Court challenge. The justices kind of sidestepped the issue of whether Obamacare could stand without an insurance mandate. The law was originally put in place in 2010 by Barack Obama. It's actually called the Affordable Care Act, and it has become so popular across political lines because so many people have needed to access it in order to get health coverage. So in spite of the fact that Republicans have worked so hard to destroy it and that Trump relentlessly criticized it, but attempts to repair it, to repeal it, have failed. Two earlier Supreme Court challenges failed. This decision probably means that Obamacare will survive and that it will get expanded to cover more people and perhaps to cover even more circumstances where health insurance is needed. Supreme Court had a unanimous ruling on religious exemptions. There was this Philadelphia case where a Catholic agency had refused to consider same-sex couples as foster parents, and they were an organization that was working with the city of Philadelphia. City, you know, said, we have anti-discrimination principles, and if you're not going to honor those principles, then we're not going to use your agency anymore. Well, Supreme Court unanimously said, the city can be forced to do business with those who violate the anti-discrimination law. But it is based on the fact that a religious organization would have to compromise its faith in order to participate.
She's lovable, she's liberal, and she's here to bring a tone of civility to political discussion you aren't likely to find anywhere else. The Anita Rufus Show, with your lovable liberal on iHub Radio. Here's Anita.
Okay, I'm talking about Supreme Court decisions that are starting to come down because it's June. Because it's June, June. June is busting out all over. Okay. Now you know why my daughter says, Mama, don't sing. A Colorado court ruled against a guy named Jack Phillips, who runs a shop called Masterpiece Cake Shop. He was sued for refusing to make a cake to celebrate a gender transition. Here's what that means. The Denver District Court said anti-discrimination laws are intended to ensure that members of our society who have historically been treated unfairly, who have been deprived of even the everyday right to access businesses to buy products, anti-discrimination laws are meant to make those people no longer treated as others. Let me take a drink. Now, this same guy had an earlier case that went to the Supreme Court for denying to make a cake for a same-sex marriage back in 2018. And at that time, the court ruled that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had an anti-religious bias against him after it sanctioned him for not making that cake. So now he's being sued again for not making a cake for a gender reveal. By the way, it was supposed to have blue frosting and be pink inside. And now a Colorado court says that he is discriminating and violating their anti-discrimination laws. Back in 2018, when the original case made it to the Supreme Court, they ruled that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had displayed anti-religious bias toward him. However, at that time, it was just about resolving that case. The Supreme Court did not rule at that time whether businesses can refuse service based on religious objections to gays and lesbians, because that's a much bigger question. If your artistic ability is what's being attempted to be purchased at the risk of your faith, that's one thing. But if you're gay and you want to buy something at Target, and Target says, oh, sorry, we don't deal with people like you. The Supreme Court has not gone that far. It'll be interesting to see if this Colorado case makes it back to the Supreme Court with this same guy who is so upset at the idea that he might have to make a cake that would celebrate a gender reveal. Here's what I don't understand, to be honest with you. Although I have no problem confronting people who I think are discriminating against me, God knows. But, you know, if what you wanted was a pink cake with a blue frosting, maybe you didn't have to explain to them why you wanted it. Well, you know, the reason I'm doing that is that I'm basically a female inside, but I was born as a male, and I want to cut the cake open and have everyone see the pink. You don't have to explain all of that, really. And since this same baker was sanctioned and then won at the Supreme Court earlier on a different claim, maybe whoever was making that cake for themselves went there on purpose. And you know what? More power to them. If this is the way we test these kinds of laws or these kinds of actions, okay. There is an interesting question, though, with regard to this Supreme Court. They issued an opinion in a very high-profile criminal justice case where the six strong conservatives held against the three more liberal members. The case was called Edwards versus Vannoy, and the Supreme Court found that the constitutional right to a unanimous jury trial is not retroactive. Now, here's what that means. There was a Ramos ruling, a case called Ramos, last year, where what they found was that instances where criminal trials were being held, and it was only a majority opinion of the jury that would sentence somebody, the high court found that was not constitutional. But then they said, having found that in the one case, did not mean that it was automatically something that could be retroactive. So somebody who's in jail right now because a majority of a jury and not a unanimous jury sent them to prison, this ruling that that was unconstitutional will not be retroactive, and that person ain't getting out anytime soon. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and you are listening to iHub Radio.
Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, I want to end the show today with the section I love the most, which I call News and Stuff. This one, well, first let me acknowledge and congratulate a young woman named Darnella Frazier. If you don't know who she is, she's the young woman who happened upon the beating and murder of... Well, not beating. I take that back. She's the young woman who happened on the murder of George Floyd and took those devastating photos, without which we would not have understood what had really happened. And she was given a special Pulitzer Prize for having taken that video, for chronicling what had happened. So three cheers for Darnella Frazier for being recognized in that way. The other thing I've got to share, I love this story. Now, for what it's worth, I'm a big BTS fan. I think those guys are adorable. That's those, what is it, six or seven or five, however many there are. I don't know their individual names, but it's that South Korean pop group, and they are adorable and really well choreographed and well managed. Well, it turns out that in South Korea, there's an emoji that has come out. It was sponsored by a feminist, an outspoken feminist in South Korea. And she came up with this emoji. And I forget now what they're how they're describing it. They kind of call it... well, I can explain it to you this way. If you hold your thumb and forefinger about 2 inches apart, curl the rest of your hand and just hold your thumb and forefinger about 2 inches apart. That's the emoji that the feminists came up with, and they're using it to characterize men. Clearly, it's the symbol used for not a very big one down there. Well, it turns out there is a huge anti-feminist movement in South Korea. Men are outraged at the idea that this emoji has come out. They have a name for it that's very innocuous, but this is what it is. And the men are complaining that this is an indication that feminists hate men. And they're using that to refer to men's size, to make men feel bad. There is an anti-feminism so associated with the alt-right movements, and in South Korea, this suspicion toward feminism is getting, well, more than 65% of South Korean men in their 20s said they equate feminism with hatred of men. I have a manicurist here at home who says she won't call herself a feminist because she doesn't hate men. As many as almost 57% of South Korean young men in their 20s said they would break up with their girlfriend if she was a feminist. They said feminism is a mental illness. For what it's worth, and you know how I am about what words mean, a feminist is someone who believes in equal rights and equal treatment for women. That's it. And anyone who knows me and my history knows I don't hate men, and I am the fabulous feminist. Here's another piece of news. San Jose, if you'll recall, 3 weeks ago, a gunman opened fire at a San Jose rail yard, killed 9 people. And as a result, San Jose, their city council, passed a law requiring retailers to videotape all gun purchases. The reason they did this, by the way, this was a unanimous vote of the San Jose City Council. The reason they did this is to try and discourage what is known as straw purchases. This is where I need to get a gun because I'm going to go hold somebody up because I just can't feed my kids. Or I need to get a gun because I'm so ticked off at the people I work with. But I can't get a gun because I was in prison once and therefore I'm blocked from being able to get a gun legally. Would you do me a favor? I'll give you the money plus an extra $100. Go in and buy a handgun for me. That's a straw purchase. And the person buying it may, in fact, be legally allowed to buy it. And they don't have to admit at the time that they're buying it for someone else. Well, San Jose said anybody selling a gun is going to have video and audio of whoever comes in to buy that weapon so that if it turns out that the gun that was used was not used by the person who claimed they were buying it for themselves, now we have a way of knowing what the hell really went on in the gun store. In Missouri, the Justice Department is now warning Missouri officials that the state cannot ignore federal law when it comes to guns. The governor of Missouri last week signed a bill that bans police from enforcing federal gun laws. As it turns out, Department of Justice officials made it clear that there's something in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause, which means that there are overriding federal realms of influence that overwhelm what any state or local municipality might want to do. It's called the Supremacy Clause, and that means that Governor Mike Parson of Missouri can't sign that into law because the federal government's laws cannot be overwhelmed by a local law that somebody decides they want to pass. And by the way, what was this law that the governor signed in Missouri? Are you ready for this? The new law would penalize local police departments if their officers enforced federal gun laws. What the hell are they thinking? Now in Colorado, haven't heard much about this, but this was a story that really caught my attention. In Colorado, they've passed a series of laws just in the last few months that are aimed at supporting and protecting undocumented people. They passed these laws after they saw that the pandemic revealed wild disparities and exacerbated inequalities in both Colorado and elsewhere. The governor signed this into law, which is aimed at expanding access to housing, jobs, and state benefits to undocumented immigrants. Supporters of this say that the laws are going to make Colorado a more equitable place. The governor said, "We can't just sit around waiting for the federal government to fix our broken immigration system. Colorado needs the contributions from everybody in our state with all different talents and skills to have good jobs and work and employ their abilities to make us all better off." There's about 180,000 undocumented immigrants living in Colorado. They make up about 3% of the state of the Colorado's population. And three cheers for Colorado and their governor for signing that into law. Those who claim this will destroy that state, well, we'll find out, won't we? Now, there's been a lot of talk about antitrust legislation against some of the big high-tech companies. And there are five bills in Congress that have been introduced with sweeping antitrust legislation. And this is all aimed at kind of restraining the big tech companies. Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google. These are companies that have the size and scope and ability that when a small entrepreneurial business is coming up with some whole new way to do computing, these companies can go in and just swoop them up, take on their technology, or they can so totally squeeze them out of the market by trying to replicate their technology that, you know, they become trusts in essence. And it's impossible to break them up so that smaller businesses can thrive. In fact, a lot of people who start up small businesses, they do it deliberately to try and get enough position in a particular market so that the big companies will come in and buy them. And that's how they get to retire and sail yachts for the rest of their lives. These five bills that have been proposed would make it easier to break up businesses that use their dominance in one area to get a stronghold in another. It would create new hurdles for acquisition of startup rivals. And it would empower regulators with more funds to be able to police the operations of these huge companies. And it leads to an interesting question. And to me, this is what always is the most interesting part of any proposed legislation. In this case, the question that we ought to be really struggling with, especially within what we call a free enterprise system. When does a business get too big to allow any competition? And when is it time to put antitrust regulations into effect to break up that big a business? These are the kinds of questions that lawmakers have to struggle with, and that's why they have very effective staffs and aides who do research on all this stuff. It's very important. Now, one big piece of news that happened this week, Congress, in spite of the fact that they seem to be at odds about almost everything, Congress has passed, both in the House and the Senate, bipartisan majorities, has passed acknowledging Juneteenth as a federal holiday. Having lived 10 long years in Texas, I can tell you why Juneteenth is such a big deal. It's June 19th, and it is the date upon which slaves in Texas finally learned 2 or 3 years after emancipation that they were free, because nobody bothered to tell them, and the people in Texas weren't in any big hurry to get rid of their slaves. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, knocked another Republican from Montana, Matt Rosendale, for his statement saying he was going to vote against the bill to make Juneteenth the federal holiday. Rosendale released a statement saying, "This is nothing but an effort by the left to create a day out of whole cloth to celebrate identity politics as part of its larger efforts to make critical race theory the reigning ideology of our country. I believe in treating everyone equally, regardless of race, and we should be focused on what unites us rather than differences. I will vote no on making Juneteenth a national holiday. This is one of those things where my only reply is, are you kidding me?
The Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, I want to finish up with a little bit more of what I call news and stuff. Things you might not know if you didn't listen to this show. The House has passed a bill to honor the first responders who tried to protect the Capitol on January 6th. 21 Republicans voted against acknowledging and honoring the first responders on January 6th. The people who were there protecting them, for heaven's sake. The bill would have provided 4 gold medals in honor of the first responders, one for the Capitol Police, one for the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, one for the Smithsonian Institution, and one for the architect of the Capitol. The 21 votes came from Republicans. And I just want to remind you that some of the justification for voting against this by those Republicans was they objected to the fact that it included the word insurrection. I did this on this show way back in January, but I'm going to do it again because words have meaning. Insurrection is a violent uprising by citizens against an authority or government, period. These people on January 6th stormed the Capitol because they wanted to stop a constitutional process of acknowledging electoral votes that had been certified by the various states to elect the president. Under federal law, insurrection is a crime, meaning you incited or assisted or engaged in conduct that was violent, and it was against the authority and the government. But people like Marjorie Taylor Greene said, I'm not going to support that because it has the word insurrection in it. So let me tell you something else about Marjorie Taylor Greene, because she is such a great topic for getting into stuff that might have some humor. As you know, she compared the requirement that Nancy Pelosi had that members of Congress had to wear face masks on the floor of the House. She said that that was just like what the Nazis did to the Jews when they put, she called them gold stars on their clothes. They were yellow stars. Well, she has now apologized for saying that she could compare the wearing of face masks to the Holocaust because she went to the Holocaust Museum. And my God, she seems to have learned something. Makes you wonder where she was for the whole rest of her life in terms of learning anything. Anyway, she walked back that statement, but then she refused to apologize for comparing the Democratic Party to the Nazis. Okay, so the wearing of masks is not like what the Nazis did to the Jews, but the Democrats basically are nothing but Nazis. This is why teaching history is so important. And this is also why qualifications for elected office ought to at least be as stringent as hiring someone for a key position in a company. Do they have any experience at governing? Do they understand laws? Can they read? Do they understand the separation of powers in our country? By the way, Marjorie Taylor Greene has also said she doesn't believe evolution exists. Now, this has been comprehensively studied by scientists and is considered a real occurrence. I don't believe in evolution, she said. I don't believe in that type of so-called science. For what it's worth, neither does my manicurist. you can guess I don't talk about too much that is too relevant when I get my nails done. The governor of Texas has signed a law banning teachers from talking about racism. Wait, what? What white Americans call critical race theory, black Americans call life. Critical race theory is about the reality of the experience of being black in America. Historically, when white people talk about banning critical race theory, what they're really talking about is racism. They don't want to talk about how racist America was and the kind of systemic racism that still exists, because they're just on the wrong side of history. Well, Governor Greg Abbott, after he signed a controversial bill that describes how Texas teachers can talk about current events and America's history of racism in the classroom, but he has now said that Texas is becoming one of several states across the country that has banned teachers from talking about America's racist past and present. So it's okay to talk about our history. It's just not okay to talk directly about racism, because the parents of white children are complaining that their kids are coming home and asking about things that the parents don't know how to respond to, because the kids are saying, did white people really do that? And the truth is, most of the parents don't know the history anyway. Meanwhile, I am happy to tell you that in Illinois, an eighth grade teacher is defending critical race theory as a valuable tool for addressing racism. So three cheers for this Illinois teacher. Name is Caleb Wells. And he went on TikTok and was responding to a question about why it was racist to oppose teaching critical race theory in the classroom. And here's what this teacher said. When you don't want to teach about how these systems were designed to oppress people, you're taking the side of the oppressor and therefore being racist. By teaching this in the classroom, we can show our kids what systems need to be challenged and thought about differently. We can dismantle racism by dismantling systems of oppression, not just by being nice to people. And this is one of the biggest challenges, and I've talked about this many times. People don't seem to understand that it's not about calling an individual a racist. It's about explaining that our system has systemic racism at its core. And now I want to acknowledge and congratulate a woman named Mackenzie Scott. She is the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos of Amazon. She has just given away another $2.7 billion to arts and racial justice organizations, and it's the third time in a year that she has given away so much money. She has now totaled over $8 billion in under a year. Three cheers for Mackenzie Scott. This is Anita Rufus, the Lovable Liberal, on iHub Radio.